disgusting chewing over and over again. It's beginning to grind into gory details. Maybe this is the last week we devote to this topic. Maybe next week is the last week we devote to this topic. And the topic that we're studying is the issue of when is the time for Hadlakat Ne'erot on Friday evening, and when is the time for Havdalah on Motzei Shabbat. And practically, the universal practice amongst all Jews today is to light candles sometime before sunset. Maybe 18 minutes in certain places like Yerushalayim, as long as 40 minutes, or 20 minutes, or 15 minutes. But in any event, the idea is that once the sun has physically set below the horizon, it's at least Bein Hashmashot, that is, the time of doubt, and it might even be Shabbat. On Saturday night, we use the custom in almost all communities, and this is fairly recent, I would say since the 1970s, is to wait for Havdalah, that is, to declare that it's Motzei Shabbat, when there's a solar depression of about 8.5 degrees below the horizon, which translates into something between 40 and 50 minutes, although some communities are much stricter and wait a full 72 minutes, but they are in the very, very distinct minority. One of the things that the Satmar Rebbe tried to institute after he came to the United States, in contrast to what the actual practice was in Poland, in Hungary before, was to wait 72 minutes on Saturday night. Some people wait 90 minutes and so on. So this is the current practice. But in fact, there are several major variations in this practice from the Middle Ages until the present. One major variation was that in medieval France and Germany, talking about the 11th, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, even up until the 15th century, the custom was the Mekabel Shabbat much, much earlier. When Rabbi Reischer, who came from Poland to be the rabbi in Worms, arrived, he was shocked to see that on at least one day during the year, when there was some commemorative fast day of the horrors of the Crusades, fell on Friday, on Erev Shabbat. They were Makabel Shabbat at around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, leaving many hours until the actual sunset. And the famous Rabbi Yerushalayim, the author of the Trumat HaDeshen, reports that in a certain community which had a very distinguished rabbi, they would light the candles, the Mekabel Shabbat, the shul, come home, have the Shabbat meal, and then the rabbi and various notables would go for a nice long stroll along the Danube and get back home long before nightfall. So one shift was that on Friday in the medieval times, the day that it's Kabbalat Shabbat at least, and all the other things like davening Ma'ariv or saying Kriyat Shema were done much earlier than what is described, for example, in Talmudic times. A second shift that took place was a shift that took place not in Western Europe, but did take place in Eastern Europe, in Poland, Russia, and eventually also in Central Europe, was that, and this was something that took place at the end of the 16th century, the beginning of the 17th century, was for Kabbalat Shabbat to become much later, after Sunday. So we have a description by a Hasidic Rebbe that we read last time, which said that it's okay to do work and light candles 30, maybe up until 40 minutes after sunset, but don't do it 50 or 45 or 50 minutes after sunset, because then you're entering into a questionable period. The Magen Avraham, which we will review a little bit later today, also pointed out that they would be doing work or lighting candles in his neighborhood, that is, in all of Poland. He was Rabbi Kalish, I guess, from up until 15 minutes before Tzeit HaKofarim, which was also well after sunset. So the custom in Eastern Europe, as and eventually in Hungary and other places of Central Europe, excluding, say, Western Germany, was that they would be lighting candles much later. And we gave some reasons as to why both of these events happened. One of the reasons that we gave was that is one of the reasons for the shift backward in time in the early Middle Ages was because the entire secular day had shifted backward in time. So in other words, the normal day, the way the Romans used to live it and the way we live it today, was shifted back by about 3 hours. And the most famous example of that is the word noon in English, which means when the sun is directly overhead in modern English, but it refers to nones, which is the ninth hour of the day, that is 3 o'clock in the afternoon in terms of the original church services. So the services which were originally performed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon got shifted back to when the sun was directly overhead to midday. And with that ensuing shift of the whole day backwards, the Jewish community living as it did in the middle of an ambient community also shifted its day back, just as we're accustomed to shift from daylight and savings to standard time, and at least the prayers in the morning get shifted immediately because we live according to the clock as it's pronounced over the television or wherever you get your time sense. The reason for the shift later in the day, that is why in Central and Eastern Europe they started to light candles later, even after the sunset, and we saw it as late as a half an hour after sunset, was a combination of factors. One factor was the fact that the day also shifted back, that is, the secular day shifted back. We now don't eat our main meal at 11 o'clock in the morning, but either have it, many people have their main meal in the evening as opposed to in the late morning. We don't go to sleep immediately after sunset. Our day ends at, say, 9 or 10 o'clock, or even later at night, so that the whole rhythm of the secular day shifted back from about the 15th century through the 16th and 17th century. A second reason was that there were many people who were being away from home. There's a large amount of Jewish economic activity where people were away at fairs, and the fair itself did not close until after the sunset, due to perhaps the introduction of artificial illumination because of whale blubber and other sorts of things. But a third reason, one of the, that's purely internal, not external to the Jewish life, was the fact that the Shulchan Aruch appeared. We'll review that in a moment also, but the Shulchan Aruch was a popular small book, in some editions printed as a pocketbook, on something you can stick into your pocket and carry around. We're accustomed to thinking of the Shulchan Aruch as a great big tome, but when it was first printed, there were no commentaries on it. So this was just a small little book that you could carry around to refresh your memory as to what the laws were. It wasn't big, it was the predecessor of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. That is, the size was the same as, say, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, or even smaller. But we're accustomed now thinking of the Shulchan Aruch as a great big tome with the Magen Avraham on one side and the Taz on the other side and the Bir HaGva on the bottom and all kinds of Mefarshim, whereas the text of the Shulchan Aruch itself is just some tiny little piece. First of all, in the initial printings, the Ramah's comments weren't incorporated because it didn't exist yet. And in the later printings, even if you included a few commentaries by the Ramah, it doesn't take up much space. What takes up a huge amount of space is the Magen Avraham and the Taz, and the Mach, the Tashekel, and all of the other things that you have on the bottom. And the Shulchan Aruch says quite clearly, with no dissenting opinion, that the time of Shabbat is the amount of time after the physical setting of the sun that it takes a person to walk 3 1/4 mil. And if you take the minimum figure for walking a mil, which is 18 minutes, there are various opinions as to whether that translates into 18 minutes, 22 and a half minutes, or 24 minutes. If you take even the minimum figure, that means that really Bein HaShemashot, the time of twilight, doesn't start until 58 and a half minutes after sunset.
Why do we say mil? Do they mean mile?
Yeah, that was a measure of how 1,000 days. That's right, it was a Roman mile.
It was before the French Revolution.
Okay. So, the Shulchan Aruch says this black and white. And therefore, someone who is going away to a fair, I mean, the Shulchan Aruch also says something else. He says that this entire period from the physical setting of the sun until 58 and a half minutes later is a voluntary period. This is the time to which you can add to Shabbat if you want to create a Tosefet Shabbat. But it's all voluntary. So a man away from home in a fair with his Shulchan Aruch in his pocket, and it's getting late on Friday afternoon and business is still going strong, reads black and white that his custom at home of lighting candles before sunset was because they were taking the maximum for Tosefet Shabbat. There's no real religious requirement to do that, so why not take the minimum and therefore keep on working and so on until the last possible moment. So these changes took place, and what we have to investigate is why the Shulchan Aruch would write a rule, that is, the whole 58 and a half minutes are voluntary, which in fact contradicted the practice. That is, the entire community, whether in Turkey or in Spain or in Italy and in, or in Palestine or in Sfat or in Cairo, all lit candles at the time of the Shulchan Aruch the way we do today, namely 15 or 20 minutes before sunset. Why should he write that this is a purely voluntary phenomenon, which... Okay, so there's a short answer and a longer answer. The short answer we gave last week, which was that there was a contradiction between two texts in the Gemara. The Gemara in Shabbat says that from Shtiyat HaChama, Mishatishka HaChama, Ad Seita Kochavim is some figure, let's say 13 and a half minutes, that is 3/4 of a mil. And the Gemara in Pesachim gives a figure of 4 mil. So 72 minutes, if we use that same figure. So this is simply a contradiction between two texts. The same Amora, Rabba says in the Gemara in Shabbat that this is something which is 13 and a half minutes long. Twilight, the twilight zone is 13 and a half minutes long. And the same person, Rabba says in the Masechet Pesachim that it's 72 minutes long. Well, of course, it's obvious, this most simple answer is that they're talking about different things. One person is talking, in one place he's talking about the halakhic time where it's really in doubt, and then the other time he's telling you an astronomical fact, how long it takes from sunset until even the smallest star is visible. However, Rabbeinu Kam gave a rather different resolution to this problem. He said, in accordance with one opinion in the Talmud, that the earth is flat, and the firmament consists of a dome sitting over the earth, that what happens at sunset is that the sun tunnels through the firmament, so there's a little opening there, rokeach olonei rokeach, going through this window in the firmament, and therefore there's sort of like two kinds of sunsets. One is when the sun begins to enter the firmament, and that's nothing. And then, as the sun reaches the end of the tunnel and starts to move away from the tunnel to traverse back from west to east at night, that's when the real Shkia begins. So that's something that starts 58 and a half minutes after the time that the initial sunset began. So we introduce the concept of there being sort of two meanings to the word Shkia. One is Shkiat HaChama, which means when the sun begins to enter the firmament, and the other was Nishit Hishkel. Now, okay, crazy theory, because we know that the earth isn't flat and there is no such thing as a firmament. But unfortunately, the Ramban was enamored by this particular thing because it gave him an answer to something which we might not regard as a question. He was puzzled by what it means to talk about Tosefet Shabbat, or Tosefet Yom Kippur. He says, it can't refer to a time of doubt, because if it's a time of doubt, you don't have any choice. It's no voluntary act. On the other hand, and this is where we might not agree with him, it can't refer to a time when the sun is shining on the earth, because it's ridiculous to say that Friday is Saturday. Therefore, it must be referring to precisely this phenomenon that Rabbeinu Tam was talking about, namely the sun entering the tunnel. Yes? So that's how the Ramban answered. He was very proud of this. He says, I've now given you an answer to a question that nobody prior to me was able to resolve, because we don't find it particularly offensive to think that we add Shabbat while the sun is still shining in the sky, because that's what we do every week. However, for the Ramban, this was an impossibility, and therefore he adopted Rabbeinu Tam's position, which is based on this flat earth theory. And of course, the students of the Ramban, which meant the entire Spanish school, Luran, the Rashba did not agree with this, but not very explicitly. Many of the rabbinical scholars simply accepted what the Ramban had to say. And of course, it's hard to find an explicit disagreement with this, because, after all, you're not going to have the Rambam tell you that there's no such thing as two sunsets. So, as someone who hasn't invented this theory, to try to deny this theory is completely crazy. You wouldn't say, oh, you know what sunset means? It means when the sun really is no longer visible. And it also means when the sun gets out the other end of the tunnel. I mean, it's just completely... But the fact is that there was no such disagreement, or at least no such strong disagreement with this position taken by Rabbeinu Tam and the Ramban. And the Rabbi Yosef Karo, in writing the Shulchan Aruch, depended to a very great extent on prior opinions and received texts. And since he saw that this was the accepted opinion of the majority of the scholars, or at least he never saw any disagreement with this, he just took that for granted, and that was the situation. So the statement in the Shulchan Aruch is based on this flat earth theory, which was supported by Rabbeinu Tam and the Ramban and so on. So that's the short answer that we gave last week. The long answer, which will occupy us a bit of time tonight, was there was in fact a dispute between two leading rabbis who were a bit older, 15 or 20 years older than Rabbi Yosef Karo, on this very issue. And so we should first at least read the biographies of the protagonists here. So what are you passing out? Well, you can pass out one of Karo, but we're not going to get to that yet. I first want to pass out the biography of Moshe Alshavsky.
Yeah.
Let's pass it coming around. So, Alashka, Moses ben Isaac.
There actually was nothing wrong with what they observed. If you want a science-based strictly observed, which it isn't, we go by theories and so forth. But they observed he observed the way the sunset took place. Jesus gave a theory about entering the
I think what you mean is something else, and that's a very important point. What you mean is that after all, the day doesn't come to an end when the sun sets. I mean, if we're going about our work, the setting of the sun is just some isolated event. It starts to get dark, or at least the light begins to dim 5 or 10 or maybe 15 minutes before the sun sets. After the sun sets, it's still enough time, light, to do a good bit of work, and you can read for another 25 or 30 minutes by the residual light that's in the sky. So the natural ending of a day, from the point of view of human activity, is not sunset. And therefore, the question is, do you want to have a precise time for the ending of the day? Then you have to refer to a precise event. But after all, most people in most places can't see the sunset. I mean, if you're standing on the beach at Tel Aviv, you can see the sunset. But if you're in downtown Boston, the chances are you're not going to be able to see the sunset. Or if you're in a valley, you're not going to be able to see the sunset if there are mountains to your right. So, for example, to give an illustration of perhaps an extreme, very precise, but completely non-sociological definition, is the definition that the Ibn Ezra gives of Bein Hashmashot. And this is what he writes in one of his three or four introductions to his Pelush on the Torah. The Ta'am Bein Hashmashot, the meaning of the phrase Bein Hashmashot, Rega Heyot Nukudat Agulat HaShemesh Keneged Shetach HaAretz Keneged HaYoshev. This is the time when the center of the sun is exactly hitting the geometrical horizon. Oz chatsi agulat hashemesh lamala, v'chatsi agul ha'acher lamata, keneged ha'adam. At that stage, half of the sun's disk is above the horizon, and half of the sun's disk is below the horizon. So he's giving you, he was after all an astronomer and an astrologer, so he knew all of these phenomena, and he's giving you a perfectly legitimate astronomical definition of the end of the day. The astronomical definition of the end of the day is, if you geometrically calculate how the sun's disk is setting below the horizon, not what you see, because after all, what you see takes into account that the sun's light is being reflected. So in fact, but you see the sun, even though geometrically it's below the horizon for a few minutes because of the refraction of the sun, the bending of the rays. The sun's rays bend a little bit. Sure. Yeah. So the definition that he gives is perfectly precise, but sociologically irrelevant. Nobody can ever apply it to anything. But he's telling you what the right answer is. Don't pay any attention to what it says in the Gemara or anything else. This is the correct definition of the astronomical end of the day. But equally well, as Mr. Weinstein says, we can argue that defining the end of the day to simply be when you can no longer see the top rim of the orb of the sun is also artificial, in the sense that, first of all, most people in most places can't see it. And secondly, there isn't such a sudden break in the illumination that it's impossible to do with. So, in that sense, the citation that we gave, was it last week or 2 weeks ago, from the Hasidic Rebbe in that basically it's when the sun's light completely disappears, that's when Shabbat begins, and he says, don't tell me all of this nonsense about tunneling through, because we know that the earth is a sphere and the sun is setting below, but just that I sat them, is perfectly reasonable. But again, he also, being a Hasidic Rebbe and not being bound by the halachic texts that came before him, could give a common sense explanation of what was going on rather than a halachic explanation. Okay. But there was an actual event that took place. That is, there was an actual problem that arose. So let's read biographies of the protagonists, as I was beginning to read. Moses ben Isaac Alashkar, Talmudist and liturgical poet. Alashkar was born in Spain, studied in his youth with Rabbi Saul, Valenci, and Zamora. In 1492, when the Jews were expelled from Spain, Alashkar sailed to North Africa. On board, he was kept below deck with other Jewish refugees and nearly drowned when the ship foundered. He wrote a poem, Bama Akadem, inspired by the experience. Alashkar settled in Tunisia, but when the Spaniards landed in North Africa in 1510 and part of the Jewish population made prisoner, Alashkar fled. He resettled in Patras, Greece, where he established the yeshiva. Alashkar later emigrated to Egypt and in 1522 became Dayan in Cairo, where he distinguished himself as a Talmudist. His halakhic decisions were widely cited. He also corresponded with most of the outstanding rabbis. that, for example, Elijah Kapsali, David and Tamatil, and Yaakov Berav. Balashka was involved in halachic disputes with Esamu ben Sid and Yaakov Berav. In fact, he was also involved in a halachic dispute, at least indirectly. He doesn't cite whom he's arguing with the Radvaz, which we will see in a moment. Balashka was well versed in Arabic and studied the responses written by earlier scholars, especially Maimonides. He also studied Abraham and Moses Maimon's Al-Kafiya and Samuel Mahatmi Achronian's Gaon's Al-Akka. Balashka knew Kabbalah is apparent from his Kabbalistic explanation cited by Samuel Seda in his Midrash Shmuel and in several of Balashka's liturgical poems. Balashka, however, was opposed to the diffusion of secret law mysticism. Though generally conciliatory and moderate in polemics, occasionally Balashka severely criticized Balashka's statements that seemed untenable. Once he even accused his close friend, Levi Khabib, of making a statement contrary to common sense. And as we will see in the Tshuva that we will read momentarily, he took common sense into account when he was trying to deal with a halakhic question. Now, the other two people that I want to read the history of is the Radvaz. Would you pass me one of these? That's three pages collated. And this is two pages, I guess. Two pages collated. David and Solomon are Ibn Abiyad and Zimra. So Balashka lived when? What was his, what were the dates of his? He was about 10 years older, right? Balashka was 1466, and Ibn Zimra was 1479, 13 years older. Talmudic scholar, halakhic authority, and capitalist. Abi Zimra was born in Spain into a wealthy family, but by the age of 13, he was in Tzfat, possibly going via Fez. The most eminent of his teachers was Joseph Sargossi of Sicily, who left Spain in 1492 and eventually settled in Tzfat. Abi Zimra moved to Jerusalem, but shortly before 1513, emigrated to Egypt, apparently due to bad economic conditions in Palestine. There he stayed for 40 years, first in Alexandria, then in Cairo, where he joined the Bet of Akid, Isaac Sholai. After the conquest of Egypt by the Turks, and the decline of the office of the Nagid, Abi Zimra became the official head of Egyptian Jewry. He was not only Dayan, but also head of the Yeshiva, trustee of the Hekdesh, and administrator of the charity collections. He held all of these offices in an honorary capacity, as he was financially independent. Apart from his inherited wealth, Abi Zimra was apparently successful in business and as a money lender to non-Jews. His library, containing rare manuscripts, was famous. His was an open house. Isaac Akrish lived there for many years and was the tutor of his children and grandchildren. Abi Zimra exercised a great influence upon his contemporaries, which can be seen from his success in settling a quarrel between the Mustarabs, the indigenous Jewish community, and the Maghrabis, the community with origins in other parts of North Africa, and issuing many ordinances beneficial to Egyptian Jewry. The most famous of them are the abolition of the dating of legal documents according to the Seleucid era. This is very important. Up until the time of the Radvaz, all Jewish documents in Egypt were still dated with Minyan Shtarot. Minyan Shtarot is dated to the time of the breakup of the Alexandrian Empire and the establishment of the Seleucid era.
1 year from there, 2 years from
there. Right. In other words, like we count 2002 from a particular event that has nothing to do with us especially, they were counting from the Seleucid era was several hundred years prior to that.
Exclusively?
The reason, but the importance of this is that the so-called Jewish date of 5763 did not come into use in documents until, at least in Egypt, until this time.
But did they try to mark it?
No. No, no.
You had the lunar month.
You could figure out what it was, but it wasn't something that you would use in your documents. Just like you don't use the Jewish...
Okay, not in your documents, but that's what I'm saying in terms of ritual or
monitoring
the Jewish calendar.
You would not know what year this is in the Jewish calendar, except that you have a printed calendar, and you are told what it is. on the radio or something. But it's not something, but now, in all Ketubot, for example, things are listed according to the years of creation. In other words, the Jewish calendar year that we use today was not in effect in Egypt prior to the 15th century or 16th century.
It was the monthly calendar?
Sure. But when you would mark a date, it would be, say, Chav Vav Tishrei to the year, and that year would refer back to the conquest of the establishment of the Seleucid Empire.
Okay. And according to our secular calendar, which means what year are we talking about?
Well, I don't remember exactly. It's about 200 or 300 B.C.
Hmm?
323, and this is a few years after that. Okay? So that was one of his enactments. So, I mean, the point of this is that the concept that people knew what year it was back to creation, as if this was something that we've been using since creation, is just simply not so. It's the 15th or 16th century. Okay? All right. He also tried okay, that was one of his things. Formation of a Chevra Kadisha, burial society. Previously, the dead had been buried secretly to avoid attacks from the non-Jews, and the prohibition of the appointment of non-Jews as dancers and musicians at Jewish weddings. He also tried to read...
Why were the non-Jews attacking the
Arabs? There were periods of anti-Semitic attacks, even in Egypt.
Going to the cemetery is a big problem in New York.
Even in New York, when they had the funeral of Rabbi Jacob Joseph, it was a violent attack by the Irish on the Jewish community.
Was that
why the catacombs were used?
No. Well, the catacombs was used because that was the method of burial.
They played tennis in Worcester.
Mm-hmm.
And used to the
Christian. Oh, yeah, I remember. He also tried to reintroduce into the public liturgy the recital of the Amidah, both by the congregation and the reader. From the time of Maimonides, this had been said by the reader only. Remember that the Rambam found that people were talking during the Chazaras Hashatz, when the Shliach Tzidur would be repeating the Shmoneh Esrei, and wouldn't be paying attention. So he abolished the private saying of the Shmoneh Esrei. That was the Rambam's enactment in order to get some decorum in the synagogue. And so in Egypt, up until the time of the Radvaz, there would be no silent Shmoneh Esrei that the individual would recite. It would be only recited by the Shliach Tzidur. And the congregation, therefore, had to pay attention and have kavanah to be yotzeh. All of this was to avoid too much chatter in the shul. Okay. His reputation extended beyond the boundaries of Egypt, and legal and religious questions were sent to him from many communities. Abi Zimra often engaged in disputations with the Muslim and Karaite scholars, and his initially leading advantage to the Karaites became more stringent, etc., etc. This is enough for the moment. It's clear that he was a very strong personality and a bit younger than the Maharam al-Ashkar. And then, I guess, the third person, before we read the actual Shiva of the Radvaz, which I have somewhere, but it's here. Hmm? No, that's not. Well, I need two things. I need the tshuva of the... what's this? This is the tshuva of Imam Alashka. Okay. The third person whom we should study at least a bit carefully is the most famous of the three, which is the Rav Yosef Karo himself, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. Karo was apparently born in Toledo, Castile. So now we're talking about 1488, so he's, what, how many years younger than the Radvaz? 1479, so 9 years 9 years younger, and remember that the Radbaz was prominent not only in Egypt, but also in Tzfat.
Four pages. I'm not going to read all of them. Some of them are.
That's the Radbaz. I don't know. Okay. Now. Caro was apparently born in Toledo, Castile. It seems that after the expulsion from Spain, his family left for Turkey or Portugal, but it's possible that they left for Portugal even before the expulsion and that Caro was born there. It is certain that after the expulsion from Portugal in 1497, the family left for Turkey, where Caro lived for about 40 years. At first, he lived with his family in Istanbul, then subsequently, not later than 1522, he fled to Adrianople, Nicopol, and Salonika. He first studied under his father, Ephraim, who himself a distinguished Talmudist. After the death of his father, which occurred while Joseph was still young, he was brought up by his uncle, Isaac Caro. In Turkey, he apparently met with Solomon Molko, whose martyrdom at the stake in 1532 made a deep impression on Caro, with the result that he too yearned to be a martyr's death. He was also influenced by Joseph Patashek, whom he met in Salonika, and by Solomon Al-Kabetz, whom he met both there and in Nicopol. In Saloniki, and in Adrianople, there were groups of pietists and Kabbalists led by these scholars. In 1522, at the age of 34, he began writing his great work, the Beit Yosef. And in 1536, he left Turkey for Tzfat. He apparently stayed for some time in Egypt before going to Tzfat and possibly studied there under Yaakov Beirav, but it's also not unlikely that he studied under him in Tzfat. He was one of the four scholars ordained by Beirav in the failed attempt to reinstitute the smicha. However, he did not consider his ordination as sufficiently authoritative, and in his works he laid it down that nowadays we have no ordained dayanim. The Beit Din of Tzfat, which he headed, based its authority on the fact that it was recognized by the public and was great in wisdom and numbers, but not as an ordained Beit Din. After the debauchery of Beirav in Tzfat in 1538, about 3 months after the renewal of the smicha, Caro was regarded as the leader of the scholars of Tzfat. His name almost invariably appears first on all documents issued by the Beit Din and on the rulings and decisions emanating from the scholars of Tzfat and its Beit Din. He also apparently served as the head of the communal council of Tzfat. There were many halakhic differences between him and Moses and Tzfat. Caro had a large yeshiva, according to the testimony of one traveler, 200 pupils attended his lectures at the yeshiva. He wrote hundreds of responses to halakhic queries addressed to him from the whole of the diaspora, besides devoting himself to the needs of the community. A few days before his death, he ordered a ban to be issued against him, the Oranayim of Azariah de Rossi, that died before he could sign the equities. Caro's pupils, and of course that work of Azariah de Rossi is one of the great, great historical works. Caro's pupils included Moses Cordovero and Moses Al-Sheikh, who was ordained by him. Caro married at least three times, and his work
he signed. What happened to the wife?
They died. In his works, he cites traditions in the names of his three fathers-in-law, Chaim al-Balad, Isaac Saba, and Zachariah Laskel Ashkenazi, referring to each of them as Mori, my teacher. While he was in Turkey, two of his sons and a daughter died. He was survived by three sons, Solomon, Judah, and another, possibly Isaac, who died several years after. According to one tradition, the son of Caro was the daughter of Isaac Gloria. His son Judah was born 4 or 5 years before his father's death. Caro's responsa, Afkat Rochel, there's a note. Here the master of blessed memory left the paper blank. He should have added to the responsa that he was called to the academy on high. He died in Tzfat in the 13th of his son at age 87. As a mnemonic song of songs was quoted, his head is the most fine gold. He was buried in Tzfat, where his grave is still to be seen in the old cemetery. Although Yosef Caro has been immortalized by his most famous work, the Shulchan Aruch, which has become the authoritative code of Jewish law for Orthodox Jewry throughout the world, it is the least important of his works from the point of view of Talmudic scholarship. It was, as he said himself, a digest of his magnum opus, the Beit Yosef, designed inter alia for, quote, young students, and he himself set no great store by it. He never quotes it in his responsa, quoting instead the Beit Yosef. Caro began writing the Beit Yosef in 1522 in Adrianople and worked on it unceasingly for 20 years, completing it in Tzfat in 1542, although the first volume was not published until 1555. In his admirable brief introduction, Caro sets out the aim and purpose of his work, the multiplicity of codes and a tendency to give halakhic rulings without going thoroughly into the sources or giving opposing views,
together with the reliance of different communities on different codes, had brought about such a bewildering variety of local customs. His aim was to make order out of the chaos. And by thoroughly investigating every single law, beginning with its source in the Talmud, discussing each stage of its development and bringing in every possible divergent view, arrived finally at the decisive ruling. He decided against writing an independent work in order to avoid having to repeat what my predecessors have already written, but to write it in the form of a commentary on an existing code. He first thought of Maimonides' collapsed code, since he is the most famous Pasuk in the world, but rejected the idea because Maimonides posits the halakha without giving divergent opinions. He finally decided on the Arba'at Turim of Jacob ben Asher, who gives the opinions of most of the Pasuk. There is little doubt that this resolution had a decisive influence on the whole development of Jewish law. It enhanced the importance of the Arba'at Urim, already an authoritative code, to an even greater extent, and established for all time the division of that portion of Jewish law which is of practical application into four sections which Jacob Asher had evolved. There is probably another reason which Shikara doesn't mention. Jacob ben Asher, although brought up in Spain, was the son of Asher ben Yechiel, one of the greatest figures in the Franco-German school, and thus had given due weight in his code to the views of the Ashkenazic scholars, which Maimonides had virtually disregarded. During the two centuries which had elapsed since the composition of Jacob ben Asher's work, however, Talmudic scholarship had continued and flourished in Central and Eastern Europe, while it declined in Spain. Caro gives an impressive list of no less than 32 works which he consulted, from Rashi to Yosef Cologne, mentioning those who belong to the Franco-German school and those of the Spanish tradition. He adds that he uses the Zohar sparingly, and in point of fact, only rarely does it give a ruling based on the Zohar, which conflicts with Jacob ben Asher. The sense of unease in doing so is seen in the fact that in two such cases, the Magid comes to him in a vision and confirms his ruling. The Shulchan Aruch, let's get down to the bottom. It was the acknowledgement and appreciation of the perfection of this work which ultimately gave the Shulchan Aruch its unchallenged place as the code par excellence in the halakha. The fact that it was a digest of the Beit Yosef, in which a detailed examination of the source and development of every law is given, made it impossible to level against Karo the vehement criticism which had been leveled against Maimonides' code, that it lays down the law without giving sources or divergent opinions. The massive folios into which the subsequent commentaries and super-commentaries have swelled the original texts masked the fact that it was originally very brief. In the third edition, then in 1567, the text was divided into 30 sections to be read consecutively, one section daily. So the whole work can be gone over in 30 days, a task which is by no means impossible if it is read to refresh the memory. Even a pocket edition appeared. And the title page of the sixth edition, 1574, states specifically that it was designed in this format so that it could be carried in one's bosom so that it may be referred to at any time and any place while resting or traveling. So, many people have this print, the invention of the printing press had come, and many people had this pocket edition of the Shulchan Aruch that they carried around with them. So if someone was going to a fair away from home, he would have a copy of the Shulchan Aruch with him, and the Shulchan Aruch says very clearly that they, being the Kabel Shabbat, any time after sunset until 58 and a half minutes thereafter is fully bound.
Hmm?
100 years after the invention of the
Lady. Yeah.
No, this was not the first. The first Hebrew book that was printed was, in fact, the Torah.
But why did this people didn't have the Torah?
Because the idea of having a brief digest, which was just meant to refresh your memory, was really new. Yeah, it's a farm pie. Yeah, to hear and things like that. Right. Okay, so as I mentioned, the one fact that we see from this discussion is that Rabbi Yosef Caro did not like the idea of necessarily taking into account local custom as a major influence. He was more interested in what the great scholars had to say on the issue. And the great scholars who dealt with this issue said that the sun tunnels through the firmament and goes back over to the other side. But there was another question, and that had to do with the fact that there was an actual case of a child who was born Friday night
after sunset, but before the emergence of three stars.
Friday
evening, let's not call it night, after sunset on Friday, but before Tzeta Kochavim. So there may be a 20 or 30 minute period in there, or maybe a bit less, maybe a bit more, in which this baby boy was born. After the sun had definitely set, but before the stars came. Now, if you take the position that the moment of doubt, the twilight zone, begins immediately after the setting of the sun, then there is a doubt as to whether this boy has been born on Friday or has been born on Shabbat, and therefore you will postpone the Brit until a week from Sunday. You can't do the Brit on Friday because maybe the child was born on Shabbat, and even doing the Brit Milah on the seventh day instead of the eighth day. You can't do the Brit on Shabbat because maybe the child was born on Friday, and you're violating the Shabbat because it's a Milah Shelo Bismana. So if you've decided that twilight zone, the Bein HaShemashot, begins with the physical setting of the sun, then you're going to decide that this boy is to be circumcised a week from Sunday. On the other hand, if you accept this position of Rabbeinu Tam and the Ramban and the Ran and the Ritva and all of the Spanish scholars and a lot of these Ashkenazic scholars, that really the twilight and Mr. Weinstein's argument that the workday doesn't really end with the setting of the sun,